Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, July 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Adelphi University with over 30 online bachelor's, master's, and continuing ed programs. Adelphi.edu/online program. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Kelly Beers, a nephrologist at Albany Med. She has a special interest in glomerular disease and pregnancy-associated kidney disease. She also cares for patients with general kidney conditions, including chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury, and hypertension, board-certified in internal medicine and nephrology. If you have a question for Dr. Beers, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Kelly Beers and your nephrology questions coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Kelly Beers is back. Dr. Beers is a nephrologist at Albany Medical Center. She has an interest in glomerular disease and pregnancy-associated kidney disease. She also cares for patients with general kidney conditions, including chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury, and hypertension. Board certified in internal medicine and nephrology, Dr. Beers has advanced training in glomerular disease. She completed a fellowship in nephrology at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City and a residency in internal medicine at Stony Brook School of Medicine. She earned her medical degree from New York College of Osteopathic Medicine. If you have a question for Dr. Beers, call now. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Kelly Beers, welcome back. What's new?
Hi, thank you so much for having me again. It's nice to be here.
It's great. Listen, before we get to the emails and the calls, I read in your bio now twice on this show that you one of the things you have an interest in is pregnancy-associated kidney disease. Explain what's different about kidney function in somebody who's pregnant.
Oh, where to begin? So pregnancy actually changes so much about a woman's body. And one of the things that happens naturally in pregnancy is that the kidneys start getting more blood flow because there is more blood flow. We see changes in overall kidney function in any pregnant woman, whether they have kidney disease or not. Women who have kidney disease prior to becoming pregnant are at higher risk of complications during their pregnancy, including hypertension in pregnancy or something called preeclampsia, which is on a spectrum of disease that could lead to something as severe as a seizure. And that particular diagnosis is something that a lot of research is being done into, preeclampsia. And as a nephrologist, I am able to take care of patients who have pre-existing kidney disease and become pregnant who develop kidney disease while they're pregnant. I see patients who have completely normal kidney function, become pregnant, something goes off with their immune system, which can happen when you're pregnant, and the body basically attacks the kidneys, and I can treat that. I can help with the patients who have kidney disease and become pregnant, help reduce their risk of developing preeclampsia or identifying preeclampsia early. And that's really important because the only treatment for preeclampsia is actually delivering the baby. So deciding when to deliver is super important. So I work hand in hand with our high-risk OB colleagues to try to figure out what's the optimal time of delivery for baby and mom. And also women who maybe have advanced kidney disease are trying to decide if they should have a kidney transplant, because actually having a transplant makes it safer to become pregnant than having advanced kidney disease and becoming pregnant. Or if they've already had a transplant, how to make sure that the transplanted kidney stays safe during the pregnancy, things
what,
like that.
What exactly goes on when anybody has kidney disease? What is going wrong?
Oh, there's a lot of different things that can cause kidney disease. You mentioned the glomerular disease that I have an interest in. Usually a glomerular disease, the glomerulus is a part of the kidney, and the body can attack it in various ways. And so you have these autoimmune processes that can cause glomerular kidney disease. The most common forms of kidney disease in the United States are kidney disease caused by high blood pressure or having diabetes. And that's more of a long-term situation where those chronic diseases put basically strain on the kidney, lead to predictable changes that we can see either on biopsy or we can just diagnose because we're familiar with this disease process. Those are the most common things that you see as far as reasons for chronic kidney disease. But then you have your acute things. Someone could just become very sick in the hospital. They're septic. They are in what we call shock, meaning their blood pressure is very low. So their kidney isn't getting enough blood, and therefore the kidney numbers go off. The kidney isn't functioning correctly. So all kinds of things can cause kidney disease, either acute or chronic.
Okay. But what exactly happens when you have it? In other words, what's going wrong? Is just the function going, is it becoming less efficient? What's happening in the kidney?
It could be that the kidney is not processing blood correctly. So the kidney is filtering toxins out of our blood, is regulating our blood pressure, is regulating our electrolyte balance, our acid-base balance, removing toxins, controlling our volume status, making sure that we're holding on to enough water, not becoming dehydrated, things like that. And if you have, depending on how your kidneys are impacted, you could be losing protein in your urine, you could be having electrolyte abnormalities, you could be having buildup of toxins. Typically, when we get to the point where we have to start somebody on dialysis or have a kidney transplant, it's because they are at the point where their kidneys can't do those functions anymore. They can't regulate their blood pressure, they can't eliminate toxins, control acid-base balance, normalize electrolyte levels.
I'm trying to picture in my head, this is ridiculous because I have no idea, the inside of a kidney. Now, it has blood vessels, right? Mm-hmm. And they're little tiny things, yeah? And so when we start leaking protein or things like that, are those blood vessels just opening up?
So it's a shame this is a audio medium, but
yeah, you're telling me.
The kidneys are made up of millions of things called nephrons. Every individual nephron is getting blood supply coming into it, and then there's a filtering mechanism within that nephron. That's the glomerulus. So the filtering happens in the glomerulus. Blood comes in and gets pushed out basically into the nephron, which is where the fluid and solute or different particles that were in the blood get pushed into this tube.
Yeah.
And it's this very complicated. So I'm doing hand motions.
That's okay.
I can see it. You can see it.
Yeah.
As it goes along the nephron, then the kidney is fine tuning what is going to end up becoming the urine. So in your filtering part, the glomerulus, you have blood coming in, you have fluid, electrolytes, toxins getting pushed into what will become urine, and then the rest of the blood coming back out and then eventually rejoining the rest of the circulatory system.
So when you have high blood pressure, well, not you, but when one has high blood pressure or diabetes and high blood pressure, the blood pressure is, the blood is going through with too much force into the filtering mechanisms? Why is that a problem?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, with diabetes specifically, in early on in diabetes, you get a hyperfiltration where because of there's a lot of fine tuning in the kidneys with how the blood vessels going to and from the kidneys are handled with all these different hormones. I don't want to get into the details of it because I'd bore you to tears.
You'd be surprised.
but basically, there's all these feedback mechanisms happening, the way sodium is handled when you have high blood pressure, the way various hormones will be released in response to high blood pressures will affect the way the blood flow is in the kidneys. And then over time, this will lead to damage in that glomerulus filtering mechanism. With diabetes, having a lot of glucose will cause an increase in the amount of pressure as well and leads to specific changes that we see in the glomerulus.
Mm. If you live long enough, or if one lives long enough, will you experience some kidney degradation?
Yeah. So, I mean, autopsy studies have shown us that pretty much everyone is going to have some decrease in how well their kidneys are working over time. You're going to see some scarring. You're going to see some damage there just from life.
Yeah.
One of the things that's kind of tough with kidney disease is it's a very silent disease. The only way to really know you have kidney dysfunction is to have your blood work checked. So everyone should be seeing their primary doctor once a year, getting their blood work checked, looking for something specifically called creatinine in the blood. Creatinine is something we use as a marker of kidney function. It's actually something that comes out of muscle, but the way our bodies are constantly turning over our muscle, we're making new muscle, breaking down muscle, creatinine is released into the blood. And that creatinine level is excreted by the kidneys in a predictable way. So if you see the number for creatinine start to go up, it tells you that the kidneys aren't doing a good enough job of cleaning all of the blood.
No. Oh, go ahead. Keep going.
So from that number, we can then estimate what the kidney function is, and that gives us something called a GFR. Now, the problem is creatinine is not a perfect biomarker, and it actually won't really tell us that someone's kidney function is down until they're about 60%.
Yeah.
So you can actually have some damage to your kidneys but still have completely normal blood work, and we don't really have a good way of knowing that yet. But luckily, people who have that early kidney disease, it's probably not going to cause too many problems for them. But that's why a lot of people will be confused because they don't find out they have kidney disease until they're actually at stage 3, because that's when the creatinine is such that the GFR is below 60 and they actually get the diagnosis.
Now, this progression, stage 1 to stage 4, I assume, or 5, you can't go back, right? Or can you? Can you do rehabilitation and medical procedures and roll that back?
It depends on what caused it. So if you have an acute process that damage the kidneys, like you get really sick and dehydrated and your kidney numbers are off and you have what we call acute kidney injury, we will expect that usually to respond and recover to just what we call supportive care. In my patients that have glomerular disease, where maybe their bodies are attacking their kidneys, we can treat that with immunosuppression. We can give them specific medications that will help get the kidney function back to normal. There's a lot of different drug classes that we now know will slow progression of kidney disease, and in some cases can help reverse it, if, you know, giving the body time to heal itself. But once you have scarring, it really gets to the point where in most cases, I'm just trying to prevent the kidney function getting worse as opposed to getting it better.
Dr. Kelly Beers is our guest today. Nephrology on the program, 800-348-2551. As I understand it, we usually have two kidneys, right?
Yes.
When you have kidney disease or acute kidney injury, is that equally on both kidneys?
Yeah, usually. There are some instances where it's not both kidneys, but almost all the time it's both kidneys being affected equally.
Let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Kelly Beers, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Maynard Ferguson and the orchestra here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question for Dr. Kelly Beers, a nephrologist at Albany Med. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. All right, Dr. Beers, I'm going to read an email here. There are a lot of terms that I will undoubtedly screw up. Here we go. This is from Bill in Niskayuna. At age 70, I have no chronic cardiac or kidney disease. Otherwise, I'm in good health. I have a family history of diabetes and prediabetes, maternal grandfather, paternal grandmother, and father, diagnosed at age 90, by the way. My A1C is 5.4 to 5.5. Glucose, consistently 90 to 100. My BMI is 25.1. As part of my annual physical, my primary care provider includes measurement of EGFR, an estimate of GFR, in the annual blood tests. Friends and family members advise that their blood tests include GFR results. Is the use of EGFR instead of GFR based on the limitation or practice of the lab performing the test, or do I need to ask the prescribing doctor to specify GFR? Also, how important is it to know one's actual GFR? Better tell us what the GFR is.
So GFR is glomerular filtration rate.
Okay.
So as I said earlier, we check creatinine, which is an imperfect biomarker, but that's what we use.
Okay.
And creatinine is from muscle, and the way we handle it is going to be how the kidneys are working, essentially. But your GFR and my GFR are not going to be the same if we have the same creatinine because of how creatinine comes from muscle. So we take that creatinine number, comparing a creatinine of 1 in a little old lady to a creatinine of 1 in a young male bodybuilder, very different kidney function,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
So you estimate the GFR by putting that creatinine number into a very long and complicated equation that all the labs do for us that takes into account someone's age, sex, and body size. And that gives you that estimated GFR. Any GFR that you're seeing on your labs is estimated because the only way to actually truly measure your glomerular filtration rate is invasive with something called inulin. We don't do it. We do sometimes do a 24-hour urine collection in certain people because that gives us a more accurate measurement of what their kidney function is. Then we're measuring something called creatinine clearance, which is similar to GFR. But if you see GFR, EGFR in your labs, it's all the same thing.
Kelly Beers is our guest. Dr. Beers is a nephrologist at Albany Med. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go to the phones, shall we? We'll go to Gilderland, and we'll go to Tom first. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hey, how you doing, Ray? How you doing, Dr. Beers? I have a question.
Hang on just a sec, Tom. You can't hear, can you?
No, I sure can't.
Oh, that's amazing. Why don't we plug? I should have taken care of this. It's plugged in, so just adjust that knob, that round knob, and see if you can hear.
Oh, that's better.
Oh, that's better. Tom, try it again, sir.
Oh, how you doing, Ray? How you doing, Dr. Beers?
Good.
Are you familiar with corn silk tea? because I've been taking Cornstarch tea for years, and my kidneys are great. You can order online. It's a little bag. There's another good way to get Cornstarch teas. Go to any market in the Capital District and boil a corn it and wait till it cool down and then drink it. And it's really good for your kidneys, I heard. Cornstarch tea.
This is interesting, Tom. So, Dr. Beers, have you these remedies that are presumably hundreds of years old, sometimes they do have a basis in fact. Where do you stand on things like this, home remedies?
So I've never heard of Cornstarch tea, although I feel like I might have heard of on this show last time I did
might have
it.
Mentioned
I think
this
I might,
last
this,
year.
Yeah, this is like kind of sounding familiar. Yeah. But I haven't, other than this, heard of Cornstarch tea. Overall, I think that one of the issues with supplements is there's no regulation. So you don't always know what you're getting. So when people have kidney disease, you have to be really careful of what you're taking in because you never know how it's going to affect your kidneys. If it's going to be something that your kidneys are supposed to be excreting in a certain way and then they can't do it and you could have a buildup of something you shouldn't have. So I tend to tell my patients to avoid things that aren't FDA regulated. That being said, if you feel like it's working for you, I think that's just something you should talk with your doctor about.
Okay. Dr. Beers, can I say one more thing? This is a little bit different. Anyone who suffers from diabetes or hypertension, drink a little dab of apple cider vinegar. I can guarantee you your blood pressure will drop and your sugar level will drop.
Interesting. All right. Well,
if you can muster just drinking it, if you can stand the smell and get it past your gullet, I can guarantee you to knock it right down.
Well, Tom, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. Yeah, a little apple cider vinegar. I think I've had a taste of that now and again. Delicious.
My mother-in-law swears by it.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go, you see. Let's go to Schenectady. Dave, you're on.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Thanks for taking the call. I'd like to ask Dr. Beers two questions. One, do antacids have a negative effect on your kidneys? And that'll be my first question.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's actually something. So PPIs, or proton pump inhibitors, are a class of antacids. There was a big study that came out many years ago suggesting that they lead to chronic kidney disease. It's a little bit controversial. It was a huge study, correlation versus causation, but most people think that in general, if you cannot be on a proton pump inhibitor, that's things like omeprazole or pantoprazole. It was seen more in people who are on them long term. So being on a proton pump inhibitor every single day for many, many years, patients that were on that were more likely to develop chronic kidney disease. So I just ask patients to talk with their gastroenterologist about if it's really necessary for them to be on that medicine every single day. And oftentimes we'll switch it to something called an H2 blocker, which is like famotidine and medicines that end in that, which are probably safer for the kidneys.
Okay, you say probably, so they're okay. That's good to know. Also, how about antacids like Tums or Rolaids? Are they harmful to the kidney?
That should be fine. The only concern I ever have with Tums is it's basically just calcium.
Yep.
So you're just taking a calcium pill. In people who have chronic kidney disease, we want to avoid their calcium levels becoming too high, because if you have too much calcium, that can deposit in your blood vessels and lead to heart disease.
Okay, thank you. And finally, the other question was, what do you recommend that people, people who do not have kidney disease but don't want to get it either, what would you recommend that they do in terms of drinking? Drinking a lot of water, or is there something else that they could be drinking?
I mean, there's no magic number on how much you should be drinking. In general, drink to thirst. You want your urine to be relatively clear. That'll tell you you're well hydrated. You don't want to overdo it, because drinking too much water will actually lead to problems with sodium levels in the body if you take in too much water and you're not eating enough. But overall, if you're eating a nice, healthy diet, low sodium diets are better for your heart and kidneys, and staying well hydrated, that's kind of all we tell people to do.
Dave, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Kelly Beers joins us from Albany Med. And speaking of salt, this email from James at voxpop@wamc.org. James writes, the amount of salt in our general American diet is so high that it's off the charts. Sodium is obviously a necessary element for the body's survival. Given that we do need sodium, why is it that salt is so bad? Would you please explain the effect of the excess salt on our kidneys and on our body as a whole? And that's from James.
So we usually recommend people who have heart disease or kidney disease to try to limit their sodium intake to 2 grams or 2,000 milligrams, which is milligrams is typically what you see on nutrition labels. When you have too much salt, what's going to happen is that's going to lead to water retention, which is going to lead to an increase in blood pressure, which is going to put strain on the kidneys and on the heart. Sodium is the most prominent extracellular. So in the blood vessels, sodium really is regulating our water balance, our blood pressure, things like that. So having too much sodium for the kidneys to handle, it causes a lot of issues hormonally, and then that will cause the high blood pressure, heart disease, et cetera.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Let's grab a couple of more emails here before we go back to the phones. This is from Paul. I was recently diagnosed with benign kidney cysts. I'm 54. I followed a vegan diet for 25 years, which I understand is the best diet for kidney health. Can benign kidney cysts turn into a serious condition? Are they evidence of kidney damage? And that's from Paul.
Great question. I get a lot of referrals for people who have kidney cysts that are just discovered incidentally. And so basically, long answer would be... Same thing as the short answer, probably nothing to worry about. If it has been read as benign, then a simple cyst doesn't even necessarily need follow-up. Depending on how big the cyst is, I might do repeat imaging to make sure it's not growing in size. The concern is always, is that cyst going to turn into a cancer? But in the vast majority of cases, the answer is absolutely not. And we have guidelines that tell us when you need to recheck the cyst, when you need to repeat imaging, when we need to send you to urology, who actually manages cysts.
Yeah.
And as long as it's just benign cysts on the kidneys, which are very, very common with age. I can't remember the numbers exactly, but the majority of people will have them by the time.
Will most people not even know they have
them? And most people won't know. If you're not having imaging done that shows you the cysts, you're not going to know you even have them. And they do not affect kidney function at all. If you have something like a polycystic kidney disease where the cysts sort of take over the kidneys, that will affect kidney function. But just a benign cyst is nothing to really worry about. And then regarding the vegan diet, there is actually some new evidence that having a more plant-based protein diet is better for kidney health and helps to slow onset of CKD, progression of CKD, et cetera. So,
do we know why?
Probably just the way protein handling happens. We don't really know why, but just for whatever reason, animal proteins are harder on the kidneys than plant-based.
All right. This email from Dan. What's the story on phosphorus fixing with things like calcium carbonate or aluminum hydroxide to help fight CKD? First of all, what's CKD?
CKD is chronic kidney disease.
Okay, good. And then what's all that other mumbo jumbo I just read?
So when you have chronic kidney disease, your phosphorus levels can start to go up. So the kidney excretes phosphorus. Those nephrons I mentioned earlier, every nephron, when you have chronic kidney disease and some of the nephrons start to die off, the other ones will work harder to eliminate phosphorus from the body. Eventually, the kidneys become overwhelmed and phosphorus levels start to go up. That's going to affect your overall bone health through a different feedback mechanism, things like that. So people who have high phosphate, who have chronic kidney disease and their phosphorus is always high, we give them medicines that will bind the phosphorus and prevent their phosphorus levels from getting as high because that helps to maintain your overall bone health. So calcium carbonate can be used as a phosphorus binder. Aluminum is not used anymore. That was an old method that they used, but it led to aluminum toxicity. So we don't use aluminum-based phosphate binders. And then KDIGO is the Kidney Disease International Guidelines Organization, and they don't actually recommend starting with calcium-based binders anymore because of the risk of high calcium levels. So hope that answers the question.
I got to say, my head spins when you start speaking because do you know everything? All right. Do you teach at Albany Med at all?
Yeah, I have a academic title, and we teach the med students, residents, fellows.
Yeah, I bet they get a lot out of that class. All right, so mine is free, and I'm still trying to figure it out. Let's go to another email here. This one is from Tia. About 11 years ago, I was hospitalized for what started as severe flu symptoms, but turned out to be idiopathic, I think, or it says idiomatic. Is that the same thing?
Probably idiopathic.
Yeah. I was in the hospital for 10 days. Turns out I had lost a lot of blood. No lower BP noted, blood pressure, I assume, noted at admission, and an RBC of 8. Could that event have caused kidney stones about 7 years later? And if so, am I still at risk of getting them? These are of the calcium oxalates kind.
So probably not. Kidney stones is usually something either you're like genetically predisposed to get kidney stones or not. Unfortunately, some people's the way their body handles things, they get kidney stones. having those symptoms and being anemic, having the low red blood cell number, wouldn't really cause you to develop kidney stones. However, you are more likely to get kidney stones if you're dehydrated. The number one way to prevent getting kidney stones, even if you're predisposed to getting them, is to drink a ton of water, because you keep your...
But not cranberry juice?
Cranberry juice can be helpful in preventing urinary tract infections, because there's something in the cranberry itself that makes it hard for bacteria to stick to the ureter.
Ah, okay. All right, fair enough. One more email, then we'll get back to the phones. Dr. Kelly Beers is our guest, a nephrologist at Albany Med, 800-348-2551. This one's from Irene. I was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, 3B, a few years ago. With exercise and a plant-based diet, I was able to improve my GFR from 34 to around 50. I'm very disciplined in my self-care. I take 24 milligrams of atorvastatin to help keep my blood pressure down. I get anxious when I read about atorvastatin possibly being carcinogenic. What are your thoughts? Are there better options? Also, when eating a low-protein diet to protect my kidney function, it was recommended that I take keto analogs, which provide added protein without the stress on the kidneys to process. Do you know anything about this approach? And that's from Irene.
So congratulations on improving your GFR, Irene. That's awesome. Atorvastatin is actually a cholesterol medicine. It's not a blood pressure medicine. I think the email had said to lower blood pressure. So as far as the statins go, I don't feel comfortable commenting on the carcinogenic risk for the statins, but it's from a kidney perspective, atorvastatin is safe. There was a head-to-head study comparing atorvastatin and rosuvastatin a few years ago that showed that people on rosuvastatin, the brand name for that is Crestor, were more likely to have kidney disease, blood in the urine, and protein in the urine. So I take my patients off of rosuvastatin and put them on atorvastatin.
Okay.
And the brand for that is Lipitor.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones with Dr. Kelly Beers. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. If you have time when you're writing the email, if you could not put the initials and the actual names in there, then I probably have a better chance. But ultimately,
You're doing a great job.
Well, you know what? Thank you very much. Let's go to, let's go to Pennsylvania. Jim and Madam Morris, you're on.
Are the three most common bacterial kidney diseases changing over the years?
Are the most common bacterial kidney diseases changing over the years?
Do you mean like urinary tract infections?
Well, yeah, well, I imagine E. coli, Escherichia coli is the first one, and then Aerobacter aerogenes or whatever they're calling it now. Maybe Klebsiella.
Yeah, so I'm not an infectious disease doctor. E. coli is definitely a very common cause for urinary tract infections. Usually if you have a urinary tract infection, or even if the kidney gets infected and you have something called pyelonephritis, it usually doesn't actually impact kidney function, luckily. So that's not something I will directly manage. If my patients get urinary tract infections, I definitely treat them. But as far as what bacteria are most common and everything, I let my infectious disease colleagues take care of all of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call. All right, one more call, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll get back to it with Dr. Kelly Beers. Let's go to Wappingers Falls. Ann, you're on.
Hi. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I have a question about kidney transplants and liver transplants, etc. I would be willing to donate, but I had colon cancer 52 years ago. Would that make a difference?
So it's up to the center, the transplant center. They have different guidelines about who they will take as a donor. Typically, they do not take altruistic donations, meaning someone just saying, I'd like to donate a kidney, in people who are over a certain age. So that's kind of the number one thing. They will take directed donations.
And what's the age?
It depends on the center. Every center has different guidelines. So if you were interested, you'd have to check with the centers. But as far as your cancer history, if you don't have any cancer at all and you're a good candidate to donate, then they probably wouldn't hold that against you. There's a lot of testing that a potential kidney donor has to go through to make sure that it is safe for them to give up a kidney.
All right, Ann, thanks a lot and good luck. So when you receive a kidney transplant, the same things we always hear about, oh, we have to watch for rejection and this and that? What happens? Why do you reject it?
So it's a foreign thing in your body, right? And our immune system is trained to get rid of anything that's foreign. And so everyone that has a transplant has to be on immunosuppressive medications, meaning suppressing the immune system so the immune system doesn't attack the kidney and try to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So a rejection is when the body is attacking the kidney.
Dialysis is basically filtering. It's doing the filtering, right, for you?
Yeah, it's replacing the function of the kidney. So with dialysis, there's two ways that we do it. There's hemodialysis, which is where you take blood, you run it through the machine. The machine will remove electrolytes, acid, and toxins, and then excess fluid, and then return the clean blood back to the patient. You can also do that through the belly with something called peritoneal dialysis. And in that case, fluid is actually put in the patient's abdomen and sits in there for a specified amount of time. And then the patient's peritoneal membrane, which is the membrane inside our abdomen, actually acts as the dialysis filter. And so the toxins will move across the membrane, and then the fluid will be drained out.
Interesting. Well, here's why I asked the question about dialysis. You know, years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, we had the artificial heart, the Jarvik 7. Is there something or something on the drawing board where there can be an artificial filtering device? I mean, heck, we see pool filters. I mean, why can't there be a more advanced device that you can implant in someone?
So they are working on trying to do stuff like that, and that's been in the works since I was in college, which was longer ago than I'd like
ago.
To admit.
Yeah.
And the real issue is that to do dialysis with the dialysis machine, the biggest thing is water. So you need a lot of water going in the dialysis machine. It has to be clean water. And it's just, you need a lot of, it's a size. It's a size thing. You can't make that filtering mechanism small enough to just put in someone's body because of the need to have the water.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Dr. Kelly Beers is our guest. Dr. Beers is a nephrologist at Albany Med. Number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. John Schofield, that's Hangover, it's a different show. 800-348-2551 is our number, and voxpop@wamc.org is our email address. Dr. Kelly Beers is educating us about nephrology today, and this email came in from Amy. I'm 73, female, on Flomax. Today the pharmacist told me it should have passed. The subject heading is stones. That probably is the clue. Would you agree with this? And that's from Amy.
You want me
to start again?
No, it's fine. It depends on the size of the stone. So if they put you on Flomax to try to help the stone pass, if you haven't felt that the stone has passed, it probably hasn't. But if it was small enough, it could have passed without you feeling it. The only way to know if it passed or not would be to do imaging.
And kidney stones are very painful, yeah?
Yeah, usually.
I tell you what, we had an engineer here 25 years ago. I'm in a lot of pain. And then he came out of the restroom with a stone in his hand. And I said, you know what? I don't need to see that. Okay. But he felt much better after that.
Yeah, you feel great after.
All right. This is from, doesn't say. Oh, it's from E. On a previous Vox Pop a few years ago, a nephrologist said there is a different form of dialysis that doesn't involve attaching to blood vessel ports using a device that makes contact with surface abdominal skin. So we just talked about that, right?
Yeah, that's the peritoneal dialysis.
Okay. Well, E, thanks for that one. And Stephen in, doesn't say where, how does what you drink affect kidney function? Think water, alcohol, Gatorade, coffee, energy drinks. And what is the CK level in the blood, and do the kidneys affect it?
So anything that has caffeine in it is going to act like a diuretic. So basically coffee and also anything that has alcohol in it is going to act as a diuretic. So when you're drinking caffeinated or alcoholic beverages, they're going to actually dehydrate you, not hydrate you. So that's really the big difference between types of drinks.
Okay. This is from Bell. Could you please discuss polycystic kidney disease progression?
Sure.
That's a vague question.
Polycystic kidney disease tends to be a progressive disease in most cases. As the cysts grow, the kidney function gets worse. There's something called Mayo classification, where we classify based on your age, your GFR, and how big your kidneys are, how at risk you are of rate of progression, essentially. So if you have polycystic kidney disease, even if you have the gene for polycystic kidney disease, you should be seeing a nephrologist. You should have imaging done to get a baseline. There is a medication that we put people on who have higher risk of progression of kidney disease that can help slow the rate of progression.
You know, this is the first time I've ever heard anyone mention size of kidneys. Is there an optimum size?
Yes. If they're too small, it could mean that they're decreased in function. They're like withering kind of thing. Interestingly enough, people who are born premature actually have less nephron mass to begin with, so they could have smaller kidneys and are more likely to get chronic kidney disease. Early diabetics, their kidneys tend to actually get a little bit bigger, and then they'll kind of shrink back down. And then polycystic kidneys, because they grow these cysts, they get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, okay. Let's go back to our phones with Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med. We'll go to Saratoga, and it's Brian's turn. Brian, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Hey, Doc.
Hi.
My question is, of late I've been hearing a lot about, even on NPR, and reading about plastic leaching from all the plastic that we use, whether it's plastic bottles. And I know that the kidney is the filter, and I've been reading about how they're finding plastic within our body. And I was wondering if you have any knowledge on any plastic showing up in the kidneys. I know it's kind of early on, but I was just wondering what your take was on this subject. And I'll hang up now.
Brian, thanks a lot.
I don't know of any studies that have particularly been done looking at the impacts of plastic and various plastics on kidney function, but I also think it's interesting, and I'm sure we'll learn more.
All right. Thank you for that one. Now we go to Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Abby, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I am 57, very healthy, and I have a pain in my left side in my back, I believe, where my kidneys are. And I've had this pain pretty regularly since the end of April following a UTI.
Okay.
I've seen my doctor twice, and they did an ultrasound saying that nothing came back showing in the kidneys. However, several years ago, I had an MRI that showed I had several bilateral stones that lay low in the kidneys.
Okay.
My question to the doctor is, when I'm going to see my physician again, is there a suggestion for some testing I might request?
So we get a lot of questions about kidney pain, and the reality is the kidneys themselves don't have the nerves to have pain. So if you have like chronic kidney disease or something like that, it's not going to ever hurt. However, stones could cause pain, of course, because pain is when something is you have to have a nerve that's sending the signal to the brain telling you have the pain. And when you're passing a kidney stone, it's going to go through areas where it will hit those nerves and cause the pain. That's why kidney stones are so painful. So if you're having pain in your back by your kidneys, especially if it's radiating around to the front, that could signify that there could be stones there. If the ultrasound didn't show any, they could always do like an X-ray or even a CAT scan to see if there are stones there. The only other way that you would have pain from your kidneys is if the kidney itself was infected and really inflamed and pushing on other things causing pain, which you'd be very mm-hmm. sick and you would know if that was happening. So if you're still having the pain and you're concerned okay. It could be a stone, you could ask about getting a CAT scan potentially. And if that's all normal, it's probably just a muscle.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Thanks, Abby. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number to Delmar. Adam, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I've heard, actually read somewhere that if you consume more than 40 grams of protein a day, that it can damage your kidneys. I just wanted to know if there's any truth to that.
It won't damage your kidneys. I think I mentioned earlier that plant-based proteins are definitely better for the kidneys than animal-based proteins. There was like an old teaching that we would tell people with kidney disease to try to do a really low protein diet, and some people still try to follow that. But it does seem like if you're doing more of plant-based proteins, the protein itself isn't necessarily the problem. It's the source of the protein.
Okay, well, that's great because I'm actually vegan, so
perfect.
I guess that's a good reason to be vegan, you know.
Okay, well, enjoy it. What's the difference qualitatively between animal-based and plant-based protein?
I don't know. Sorry. I wish I did.
I admire your candor. You didn't make anything up. Good job. Bonus points. Elizabeth in New Paltz, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
I was the person who asked the question with the email.
Oh, you're E.
Gave the answer about the peritoneal.
Hello, E.
The reason I'm asking is because my brother chose to go off dialysis, which had the expected result. Is there any time when the peritoneal is not an option where maybe he would have, you know, agreed to that instead of the option he did choose?
I mean, every patient is different, and there's going to be reasons for offering peritoneal versus hemodialysis. Peritoneal dialysis is done at home, and so people need to be able to do it themselves or have a care partner who will do it for them. And you also have to have a home environment that's going to be safe for peritoneal dialysis. The biggest risk that we have with those patients is infection. So if there's like a lot of pets or there's not enough space in the home to do it, or again, if the patient can't do it themselves or they don't have a caretaker to help them do it, that those would be reasons to not do peritoneal dialysis.
But if somebody is in a nursing home like he was at the time and getting very close attentive care, this is in North Dakota, he got great care. I mean, this is after the fact, but just to know in the future for anybody else that comes across this, is that an option that somebody can choose when they don't want to do the standard dialysis and they do have the ability to have somebody help them with it?
Yeah. The only issue is a lot of nursing homes don't do peritoneal dialysis. We have that issue sometimes where our peritoneal dialysis patients will actually have to switch to hemodialysis when they go to the nursing home because they just can't get the PD at the nursing home.
All right, Elizabeth, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Albany, and Cynthia, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. 14 years ago, I was diagnosed with gestational diabetes when I was pregnant with my son. I was about 36 when I had him. But my glucose levels never exceeded 86 prior to breaking my morning fast. And at 28 weeks of gestation, I developed gestational hypertension. And at week 30, I was induced with he was healthy. He continued to thrive. My gestational diabetes was allegedly resolved with the birth, but my blood pressure, because I end up having gestational hypertension, I was preeclamptic, and my blood pressure ever since having my son, it never went down. It was always up there, and this is prior to pregnancy, I always had a low blood pressure. I was given a bunch of prescriptions, and they never quite worked for me. And then I was noting that I was always running on fumes. I was tired. But then I was always given an excuse like, oh, it's motherhood. Oh, it's you're working, marriage, my age. And also, I noted, though, when I was doing my blood work, that my potassium levels were dropping every time I would take my get my blood work done, and also would get a lot of episodes of muscle cramps. I noticed that I was getting water retention and I had a slow metabolism, and so then it up to about 10 years later. Finally, I had someone in renal run a sodium test, and I was diagnosed with hyperaldosteronism. So that means that my hypertension that I had was not a primary, was secondary. And they said they were going to look into my adrenal glands and see if they could remove a cyst, if there was any cyst in there. But they said that they couldn't find anything that was operable. So they gave me spironolactone, and I had scripts for potassium. And I've had issues with the potassium dropping so low that I had to, you know, go to the emergency room a few times. Well, now, after these episodes were happening, I had bariatric surgery, and I was taken off of spironolactone. Now, my problem is, or issue is, since it's possibly genetic, and since I was removed off of spironolactone, is there any, like, a holistic way to keep my potassium levels up besides eating more potassium, which is what I do? And are there any treatments to prevent hyperaldosteronism from becoming or slowly turning into kidney disease?
So with hyperaldosteronism, that's a hormonal abnormality, meaning you have too much aldosterone, and that aldosterone is what's driving your high blood pressure and making you excrete extra potassium, so you're losing it in your urine. And the aldosterone, the spironolactone will basically reverse that. So if they took you off the spironolactone after your surgery, I'm assuming that means your blood pressure is normal now?
No, it's not.
Oh, it's still
high?
That's
the thing. I constantly have to, they retake my blood pressure. I have to do all these breathing exercises just so it can get to a part where they don't want to keep me in the office.
Yeah, you should probably be on the spironolactone, especially if your potassium levels are still low. And if you have hyperaldosteronism, that doesn't just go away. So it's probably something you should talk to your doctor about, potentially getting back on the spironolactone. And having your blood pressure normalized is what's going to prevent you getting kidney disease as a result.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot for the call. Very quickly, we have about a minute left. Let's go to Hudson and Liz. Liz, go ahead. This is an interesting topic. You have 30 seconds to pose the question.
My husband has had two kidney transplants, and he did home hemodialysis for the second one. I was wondering why we weren't offered it for the first one, why it's not more widely made available. He had great results with it. I was wondering why that.
Okay.
I agree, Liz. I think everyone should be on home dialysis if they can be. Okay. Home hemo, peritoneal dialysis, home is the way to be.
Okay. So when you
we didn't even know about home hemo. Yeah.
So when you do home dialysis, it is through the port in your tummy?
So you can either do the peritoneal, which is through the port in the tummy, or you can do actual hemodialysis at home, where that's the blood one, where it's either through a fistula or a graft or through a catheter, a blood catheter. And you hook yourself up to the machine and you do your dialysis at home.
But you said it requires a great deal of water, yeah?
Yeah, so you hook it up to the water in the house.
And it could be tap water?
Yeah, they go and they test your waters. You have to bring in water samples, and we make sure the water is clean and safe and everything.
That is so interesting. Well, there are many more emails and many more calls, but we're done. We are done here. Dr. Kelly Beers, you made your yearly appearance and survived yet again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support comes from Adelphi University with over 30 online bachelor's, master's, and continuing ed programs, adelphi.edu/online program. Well, once again, thanks to Dr. Kelly Beers of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Real sorry if we didn't get to your calls or emails. We'll do the topic again. Fear not. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we were going to talk car maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke, but he was a late scratch. So we're going to do something I don't do very often on this show. We're going to open forum it. We're going to open the phones. We're going to find out whether you think President Biden should bail out on the campaign or keep going. That's tomorrow at 2. Our news director, Ian Pickus, will be here to provide a little context. And then, Zach, don't cringe. It'll be okay. It's just an open forum. We'll see you at 2 o'clock for that one.